RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So to the 12-year fight to extradite Kim.com, and we're inviting David Harvey, former district court judge and media law expert, on to talk about this. Just a quick bit of background first. Obviously, former judge, David also former mastermind winner and blogger with a specialty in internet and media law. He blogs at A Halfling's View on Substack, and David was involved in the Kim.com extradition case 12 years ago. So it'll be really interesting to hear what he has to say. And just a bit of background on Kim.com. Born Kim Smits, 1974, Kiel, Germany, a German-Finnish internet entrepreneur and political activist. He holds dual citizenship of Germany and Finland. He's also held New Zealand residency. .com founded Mega Upload, a file-sharing website, way back in 2005. The site gained massive popularity but was shut down in 2012 by the U.S. Department of Justice, alleging copyright infringement, racketeering, and money laundering. .com was arrested in New Zealand at the request of the U.S. government and faced extradition to the United States. David Harvey, welcome back to RCR. Thanks for coming back on.
Thank you.
Long-running case, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed.
Okay. Let's first of all talk about your involvement all those years ago in the case. You were about to hear the case, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I was assigned to deal with it, and I did a couple of hearings at an early stage about making discovery available and things like that. And then I unwisely made a throwaway comment that meant that my, shall we say, bias could have come into the picture. And so I immediately disqualified myself, which was the only thing that I could do. It was a silly thing to say. Shouldn't have been said, but things go the way they go. But I've kept an eye on the case ever since.
What did you say, David?
I was at Internet NZ conference. I was going to deliver a keynote speech. There was a line in that keynote speech about responsibilities that users have when using the internet, and took a line from the comic strip Pogo, which was, the line was, "We have met the enemy and he is us," which is pretty banal.
Yeah.
But at an earlier thing, there was a discussion about copyright and the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the way that had New Zealand or had the United States joined the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they would be imposing their copyright laws onto ours. And I made the comment, "We have met the enemy and he is us, US."
Okay.
Right. I didn't say US, I just left it like that. Well, of course, it was very obvious. And the next thing that happened was that I had Hamish Fletcher, who was then with the business section of the New Zealand Herald, coming after me and doorstepping me and doing all sorts of stuff.
Okay.
So, yeah, that, it was stupid, it was silly, it was ill-advised, it was certainly not the type of comment that a judge should make, and therefore, off the case. Yeah.
All right, the arrest of Kim.com, I'm remembering that now. That seemed to be, well, over the top and, what, performative? How would you describe that whole arrest of him?
It was fairly typical of the type of thing that the Americans love to do when they've got a high-profile person that they've arrested, and it's called a perp walk or a perpetrator walk. And what they do is they do the arrest, and then they do this full sort of media affair where they parade the accused person in front of all of the cameras and reporters and so on and so forth and photographers and get as much publicity as they possibly can. I think in some respects, the raid, if you like, on what was called the dot-com mansion in Coatesville was part and parcel of that. It really seemed to me, on reflection, to be quite unnecessary, because the occasion where the four gentlemen who were involved in the dot-com business and Mega Upload were gathered was for Kim.com's birthday. Yes, there were firearms present, and that created something of a problem, but nobody actually thought of going up to the door and knocking and saying, "We have a warrant for your arrest, please come out." Rather, they deployed helicopters and armed offenders, people, and so on and so forth, and made a big show. I think it was probably at the behest of the FBI, but certainly something that is not part and parcel of law enforcement here in New Zealand. The only other thing that I can think of that was similar to it was when they had that difficulty with those people. I think it was in the Urawaras, and there were firearms problems and so on and so forth, where they did a big hit. But anything else, nah, it's silly and not really the way that it should be done, particularly when you've got things like the presumption of innocence and so on and so forth. And the inference that is being drawn is you've been arrested, you're guilty. It's not a good look from all sides of the equation.
I think John Key was the Prime Minister then,
yeah,
leading the government. He would have given his approval to that, I would imagine.
Not necessarily.
Really?
No.
Okay.
The way in which that operation was carried out would probably have been, and I'm speculating here, but it would be an operational matter on the part of the New Zealand police, and politicians don't have anything to do with operational matters on the part of the police. Uh-huh. There may well have been some kind of input from foreign affairs about the involvement of overseas law enforcement, but no, I don't. Dotcom has come through with this conspiracy that John Key knew all about it before it happened, and it may well be that was the case. I don't know. And I don't know that there have been any OIA requests that have revealed to the contrary. But I think to assume that Key was involved in the decision-making process is not a proper assumption to make.
What was Mega Upload all about, David?
It was about file sharing.
Yeah, so it was a cloud operation.
It was a cloud operation that had developed. And those sort of cloud operations and file sharing operations had developed from about 1999 and perhaps even a little bit earlier with an outfit called Napster, which enabled people to share music. And the Napster model grew into a number of other models called Grokster and LimeShare, I think, and so on and so forth, which involved the sharing of music and at times video files. The advent of the cloud meant that limitations on the number of files and so on and so forth had just flown out the window, because you had virtually unlimited storage on the cloud. And what the Mega Upload model did was that it enabled people to share all sorts of information, not only music, not only movies, although that was a large part of it, but also on the part particularly of servicemen in Afghanistan. They were able to share videos and so on and so forth of family using the Mega Upload model. So when Mega Upload went down in 2012, it was not only music and movies that went with it was everything else.
Was it perceived by American authorities, agencies, as some kind of security threat? You just mentioned Afghanistan and all sorts of videos coming out of there, I guess, could have been hosted.
No, it wasn't a security threat. The main move to shut down Mega Upload came from the movie industry and from the recording industry. But that was back then. I mean, the now is totally different. We're in a completely different environment. I mean, New Zealand, for example, introduced some file sharing laws as far as the Copyright Act were concerned that related to music. Those particular laws, music and movies, those particular laws were initially enforced, but not very much. And there are hardly any cases, if any cases at all now, because file sharing is no longer an issue.
Yeah,
sure, it happens, but it is no longer the big issue that it was in the early 2000s to the mid 2000s. You know, we've moved on from that. Streaming services have changed the environment completely. And in some respects, it's sort of, you know, do we really need to look back and deal with this particular problem, because it is just so old? You know, Mega Upload and file sharing is no longer the threat to the movie and music industries that they used to be.
Yeah, I'm just reading a quote or two here from a Hollywood Reporter piece on this from quite a few years ago, where there is a comment or a few quotes from Kim.com. He says, "The internet frightens you, but history has taught us that the greatest innovations were built on rejections. The VCR frightened you, but it ended up making billions of dollars in video sales." And he said, "So you get comfortable with your ways of doing business that any change is perceived as a threat. The problem is we as a society don't have a choice. The law of human nature is to communicate more efficiently, and the economic benefits of high-speed internet and unlimited cloud storage are so great that we need to," and so he goes on. Absolutely bang on.
Quite correct. Any new technology that threatens existing businesses is seen as a major problem. And the response by the movie and music industries to the internet, which was a completely new communication system that introduced a new paradigm, was to stop people doing whatever it was that they were doing. Whereas, in fact, what they should have been doing and what they have done is to change their business models. Now, what has happened is that the movie industry has said, okay, we're not going to be able to deal with file sharing, but what we're going to do is make our product available to people for a reasonable cost. So you get streaming services set up like Netflix and all of the others. And in the same way that you have the music industry that has set up a system where you can actually play the songs that you want to hear.
Yeah, Spotify.
Rather than buy an album to do it.
Mm.
And there are all sorts of facilities like Spotify and so on and so forth that enable you to do that. So in that respect, they've changed their business model. An example of organizations that refuse to change their business model or are unwilling to or reluctant to change their business model, is the news media. And we're going through all of this right now with this digital media bill that the government has put in place that provides another subsidy for news media. And I say, change your business model. Work out a way that you can get your news to the public at an acceptable price, because nobody wants to buy newspapers anymore. And if you're going to put everything up behind a paywall, you're never going to get the readership that you want. So work out an entirely different business model. This is a paradigmatic shift, Paul. You can't sort of say, oh, we'll tweak what we had before. No, you can't do that. You've got to change it entirely. Streaming services, for example, for movies and music is an example of that.
Yeah, back to what you said just before I read those quotes out. Why all this time later is this latest development happening where this tradition now it seems to have been signed off? Why hang on to this, do you think?
Well, the request for extradition came through in 2012. That's how it started. And it's remained alive and well. So the New Zealand courts are obliged under the law to rule on the issue of extradition. And after a number of hearings, a district court judge held that the necessary qualifying offences and so on and so forth were established, not necessarily proven, but established, and that extradition should happen. The funny thing about it was that the principal concern that the Americans had was under their copyright legislation, which had absolutely no parallel in New Zealand. So they had to sort of find a number of other qualifying offences, which they were able to do. So district court judge holds that he should be extradited, and then the appeal process started. And once the appeal process was concluded, it was up to the minister to make his or her decision about extradition. The matter was in the hands of, I think it was Kerry Allen, and nothing was happening. But it certainly was, it hadn't gone to sleep or anything like that. But the interesting thing about it is that in between that, two of .com's co-offenders, if I can put it that way, Matthias Ortman and Brad van der Kolk, did a deal with the American authorities. They would plead guilty to some charges under New Zealand law that reflected exactly what they had been doing, and they would be sentenced according to New Zealand law, and they would serve their sentence here in New Zealand. .com would have nothing of that. He wouldn't have a bar of it.
Okay.
But the other interesting thing that develops from all of this is the extraordinary length of time that it's taken. And the fact that in another case involving an attempted extradition, that of Julian Assange, that was resolved by way of a deal. Now, what had happened with Assange was that he had been kept in custody by the English authorities because he jumped bail and gone to the Ecuadorian embassy, which was fairly novel. And then he was subsequently rearrested and held in custody. He'd been held in custody for a long time. And ultimately, the deal that he negotiated was that he would plead guilty to a sort of token offence on the island of Guam, or one of those islands, and he would be sentenced to time served, and back home to Australia he would go. Now, there were suggestions, and I don't know what the detail is, that the Australian authorities negotiated this through with the American authorities because Assange was an Australian citizen. Whether or not a similar sort of deal could be struck relating to .com is purely a matter of speculation because, of course, he's not a New Zealand citizen. And so that citizenship aspect that Assange had doesn't come into play. Furthermore, .com hasn't been in custody, so it isn't as though he could do a time-served sentence. But one wonders whether or not, given what happened to his friends Ortman and van der Kolk, it may not be an idea for some discussions to be started about trying to get some kind of deal that allows him to stay in New Zealand. Because once he goes to the United States, he's never going to come back here again.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. What's he in for if that happens?
There are very, very serious penalties under American law for what it is that he's done. Whether or not those penalties will attract is entirely another matter. And of course, the passage of time and the changing technologies and all of the differences that have taken place over the years could well impact upon that. And it may well be that the American authorities could say, oh, do we really need to go through all of this? And that might prompt a resolution. But, you know, if they still have their fangs out, as they had in 2012, the penalties that he's suffered might involve years in an American prison.
Okay. He's just been on X, actually, with Alex Jones. Some people say, well, you know, big deal. But 2.2 million views in a day. And he's very heavily, incredibly critical of the US government hegemony. He's saying their money system is about to collapse. Derivatives are going to take it down. He went through the whole thing. That can't set him up for a very good reception.
No. I would have thought that his best approach would be to be as conciliatory as he possibly could towards the American government at the moment, but that's not his style.
No.
His style is to throw his not inconsiderable weight around.
Could the Minister of Justice not sign that and it would have been okay?
It would have been possible for the minister to say, we're not going to allow extradition to take place. And that has happened in some cases. In one case that I can clearly recall in the United Kingdom, there was a young computer hacker that the Americans wanted to extradite to the US. He had all sorts of mental health issues and so on and so forth. And the courts in the UK said, no, we're not going to allow extradition because this would be, you know, harmful to his mental health and so on and so forth. So there were humanitarian grounds for not allowing extradition to take place. There are circumstances where, for example, if somebody was facing the death penalty overseas, that the New Zealand government would be unlikely to grant extradition because it meant would basically be a death sentence for the person. And we don't favour capital punishment, and rightly so. So, yeah, there are circumstances where it would be refused, and it could have been refused in this particular case, although I must say that I would struggle to find the grounds for refusing it.
And do you think there's any potential for being lent on? I mean, we've been kind of cozying up to our traditional allies, let's say, recently, and I guess also the National Party is probably off the top of their head more likely to walk in some sort of step with those traditional allies. Do you think there's more to it than just, you know, strictly legal, that there are other considerations, foreign policy considerations, relationship considerations that are bundled up in this as well?
It's been a matter that's been on the Minister of Justice's desk for some considerable period of time. So it isn't as though this is a new thing that the Americans have said, we want this dealt with. It's been around for a while. It's been pending for a while. Extradition decisions aren't often made on the fly. Now, I don't think the Americans have sort of come calling, yeah, saying we want this guy extradited or anything like that. I don't think there's been pressure to bear. It's been on the minister's desk for a while, for a number of months, a large number of months. And I think that maybe the minister has finally got to it under the pile of other stuff that he's had on his desk.
Okay.
And has taken advice.
And the other thing, again, historically, I'm just thinking the way that US politics works and the way that the political system is funded, Hollywood probably were a big contributor to that. So kind of payback, you know, cashing up on the support, going after someone like Kim.com, what he was doing back then, we know the model's changed now. You think there's anything in that as well?
Oh, they were the loudest voice in the room at the time. No question. The movie and recording industries carried an awful lot of weight. And that sort of California mafia of the entertainment industry in the United States was incredibly powerful. The Motion Picture Association of America, Recording Industry Association of America, hugely powerful, big donors to political campaigns and so on. And they wielded an awful lot of power. And when they spoke, politicians in DC listened.
Yeah, and acted. Right, right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
When you reflect on this case, David, go back over the years now, what are your sort of thoughts to wrap up the chat?
Well, first thing is I wish I'd never said what I said.
It is what it is.
Yeah, it is what it is. It has provided a very interesting insight into a little known area of law, which is extradition law, and which can be very, very complicated, but from an intellectual point of view is just fascinating. The other thing, too, is that it tells us a lot about the way in which technology moves. And the model that .com was operating with Mega Upload would not succeed today because people have moved on from file sharing and that type of thing. So we have to recognize that these things are just transitory only in this new paradigm that we are living in. And we have to be prepared to make the necessary adjustments and know that nothing is forever as far as the digital paradigm is concerned.
Yeah. Former District Court Judge David Harvey, fascinating to have you on this morning to talk about this. We're going to reach out to Kim.com because we're in the area now, so he can walk down to the studio if he wants and come and join us. We're going to do that. But thank you for coming on this morning and sharing your historical knowledge, the involvement initially, and thoughts, particularly on the way the industry has changed so much. Well, it would be fair to say so quickly, right? It really has.
Yep. Continuing disruptive change, Paul. That's what it's all about.
Well, that's what we're about.
Yep, absolutely.
Thank you, David. Look forward to chatting with you again on who knows what, but we'll do it again.
Okay, take care.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.